You're listening to the best of the day.
I say you and you the best.
Halford and Brough.
On a Tuesday. Happy Tuesday, everybody. Halford, Brough, Sportsnet 650. And peppy music. 6:30 in the morning. I assume most of you are either getting ready for work and or school. A bit early for school. Maybe you're in the shower. Maybe you're in your breakfast nook having a coffee.
That last conversation garnered a bunch of texts into the Dunbar Lumber text line.
I mean, it was really three people. But I get your point. You were replying.
Okay, I'm trying to.
The Nick Paul debate. I get it.
Yeah, don't downplay how many texts we're getting in. We got a bunch of texts about that conversation about size, adding size, because the Canucks need a lot of things. Like, it's funny because if you ask Jim Rutherford, do you guys need to get faster? Yes. Do you need to get younger? Yes. Do you need more size and sandpaper? Yes. Do you need right shot defensemen? Yes. Like,
what about cap space?
You know, we need more of that too. Mm-hmm. And I think it just underscores the challenge that Jim Rutherford is going to have getting all that. And I'm not saying it has to be done in a single offseason. And he mentioned that yesterday on the DFO podcast. I just don't think he thinks much of the roster. He thinks it needs a lot of change. He likes Pettersson. He likes Hughes. He likes Demko. Mm-hmm. He obviously likes JT Miller, but is he the right age for this roster, for what he's planning? He obviously likes Bo Horvat, and I think they'll get something done there. He likes Brock Besser, too, because he mentioned on this on the podcast that he wants to get him signed to not necessarily a long-term deal, but I don't think it would be ideal if it's just like a one-year qualifying offer deal. He wants to get him signed to a deal that's 2 or 3 years, which also gives, and then I think this will be part of the sell to the Brock Besser camp. If you sign a three-year deal, you're still going to be in your 20s when you reach UFA status, so you could still cash in with a pretty long-term deal then.
To the phone lines we go now, joined by our next guest, Fan 590 in Toronto, Sportsnet NHL analyst, our good buddy Justin Bourne here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. What up, Bourne? How are you? Uh-huh.
Doing well. I'm not doing great, apparently, because that was my first attempt at work, and I just had the mute button on. So the week is slow out of the gates here. I don't think I'm winning the race if it's a 100-meter dash.
Brother, I have been there accidentally pressing my face up against the phone and the mute. It happens far too often. I don't love it, but I understand your plight. I want to ask you first and foremost about hosting a show in Toronto right now in the wake of the Leafs' Game 7 loss to Tampa Bay. We spoke to your counterpart, J.D. Bunkus, yesterday, and I think he encapsulated the emotions quite well. But now today is a pretty interesting day because today's locker cleanout day, if I'm not mistaken. So you guys are going to have a whole bunch more to chew on. So this story really isn't going anywhere. They've just kind of delayed the funeral procession here. And now Tuesday, you're going to get even more of the exit interview stuff and how disappointed everybody was. So I'm curious, what's it been like for you over the last sort of 72 to 96 hours?
You know what? I feel exasperation more than anything else. Just like, oh, come on. Like, you can't, like, bank one in off an ass in overtime. We can't get some sort of round bounce around here, so I don't have to do this again for the God knows how many year, sixth, I guess, in a row. It's a really tough spot because no one wants to hear that the team is good. No one wants to hear that they were close. I don't want to say any of those things, and those things are probably true. So, you know, instead you just have to look it square in the eye and call it a failure. It was a failure. They had one goal from the start of the year. They did not accomplish that goal. It's a failure. But, you know, the debate here is like people are super emotional and they want you to blow it up. or they are super into, like, I don't know, stats and all sorts of process talk. And, you know, that's like, and, you know, next time nothing, it'll be better. So I don't know, man, you kind of talk around it and, you know, what can the Leafs really do? Try to figure out what possible directions they can take more than anything else.
What do you think of Friege's theory that this could be the summer of Kawhi for Kyle Dubas, in that he might look to make a big trade a la DeRozan for Kawhi?
I think it's the vaguest thing I've ever heard. You know, like, okay, I love Friege, and I think maybe he's right. Maybe they will. He's not trading Matthews, though. That's not DeMar. And Mitch Marner's not going anywhere. Top 10 in scoring. I mean, maybe that's the one. So maybe I won't rule out Mitch, but you can't trade Tavares. So what he's saying is either Nylander or Marner are going to go in essentially a one-for-one deal for another great player. Well, if you start to spend time on this and try to figure out how that works with salary cap situations and other teams, I just don't see how you're getting better. I don't, you know, I love the theory of it, and I hope it's true. But to me, it just seems like an idea that was neat, but I just can't. I don't know how it would practically work.
What did you make of Sheldon Keefe's remarks afterwards? The ones that he's getting the most heat for, or the one where he said that we got a lot more respect in the handshake line this time around, because he's got a real participation ribbon vibe to it. I'm just curious what your and Kipper's take was on that.
It's that the quote itself has been like really selectively clipped.
Yeah, but it's perfect. You know? It's perfect.
No, it's not. The quote itself standalone is hilarious and perfect and funny if you're like not a Leafs person. But the quote itself, he's like, you know, it doesn't really matter. We didn't get it done. You know, this is, you know, we're in the winning business and we didn't win. You know, Cooper, you know, it's nice to get more respect in the handshake line, but at the end of the day, we didn't win. And, like, everyone cut out the, but at the end of the day, we didn't win. Like, maybe he shouldn't have even said the part about the respect thing, but I don't think he was going out there being like, we did it. He's not that naive. I think we're painting him as more naive than he really is here.
We spent a good chunk of the last section of our show talking about the need to add physicality and grit and sandpaper and all those great hockey cliches, because Jim Rutherford went on the DFO podcast yesterday and said that's one of the things he'd like to add to the Canucks, and that kind of dovetailed into a conversation about Game 7 between the Leafs and the Lightning. And Jason brought up a good point, very overlooked in the aftermath, and I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that everyone was focused on the Leafs' another collapse, was that the guy that scored the winning goals in Game 7 wasn't a superstar player, wasn't even a guy that had been around that long. It was 6'4", 230-pound Nick Paul that they brought in that made the difference in one of those games. You go back and you look at Tampa Bay historically, and they have run through these guys, bottom six, sandpaper, grit, again, all the cliches. When those guys step up in those moments, I think you do kind of wonder, do we need to invest more in that? Do we need to pay more attention to that for those specific moments, right? Not games 1-82 in the regular season, but in the playoffs, where being heavier and being bigger and being more physical really does matter.
Yeah, I'm a big Paul believer. Like, I think he's a great player and the type of guy that when you look at the Ottawa Senators, you know, I just can't help but laugh. Like, you're in a rebuild. This guy is young and good and big. And, like, they offered him $2.3 million a year or something. Well, how about you pay him a little bit more money and keep the good players? They're tough to get. Like, drives me absolutely crazy, you know, like, cost efficiency down to the cent. Like, maybe just keep good hockey players, guys. So, yeah, there's real value there. You know, from the Toronto perspective, you looked at this series and said, you know, where are the advantages around there? Well, going into the playoffs, Toronto's third line is huge. McKayev's big. Pierre Engvall is a giant. You know, and they both are on pace for, you know, I think McKayev was on pace for 30 goals. So you looked at Nick Paul and said, yeah, we got one of those. But it's a place where the Leafs got beat. McKayev was ineffective. Pierre Engvall was not just ineffective. He was bad. So here it was an issue trying to find those guys. There's never any guarantee they're going to come through. But I like Tampa's strategy of just having them. Have some good young guys and hope that they find their moments to make a difference. And they sure did.
So what did the Leafs need besides better luck?
Yeah, boy, I don't know. I don't trust the goaltending, to be honest. Like, Jack Campbell was fine in the series, didn't cost him any games, but never stole one. You know, there was no game where you're like, yeah, you know, Campbell took one away from Tampa Bay, so that's an issue. And then You know, I do think that there's a greater conversation about the type of players who have success in these games. And, you know, Willie Nylander gets a lot of heat and all that, but everyone goes, yeah, look at his points. He's just not a guy who plays on the inside. If you're going to do the DeMar thing, you would start there if that were to be possible. And then you just got to figure out how do you replace the guys you have to lose. You're going to lose Mikheyev. They're going to lose some guys on D, Giordano and Labushkin are UFAs. So there's just a lot of, like, how do you replace these guys cheap? Because the main guys make so much money, you don't get to spend money to fill in those spots.
We're speaking to Justin Bourne, NHL analyst from Sportsnet and Fan 590 here on the Helfer and Bruff Show on Sportsnet 650. So the Lightning advance, they move on. I looked at that team and through that series and then what's going into tonight, because they open up their second round series against the Florida Panthers in very short order. Braden Point got really banged up in that series. I think they classified him as extremely doubtful to open the series. I know that took a lot out of a team that a lot of people were wondering how much did they have left in the tank. Anyway, you saw them through the seven games against the Leafs. What are your thoughts moving forward for this team? Is that first round battle going to be the sort of the death knell for them, that it took so much out of them? Or do you think that's going to be the jumping off point for the Bolts? He pressed mute again.
Is he on mute again?
Yeah,
he
pressed
mute. Yeah, sure. I'm sure. I'm, yep. So there's, this is one of those, they're a team where I genuinely want to know about intangibles, because like that Toronto series, it seemed like they were down out and dead. And the second things got real tight, like Vasilevsky made an extra save or two and Hedman made an extra play or two and Braden Point scores the OT winner. Like, do you believe in all this sort of stuff about knowing how to win? Because to me, looking at Florida should just beat them. Like, Point is not going to play. Sorelli was really hurt at one point. They're limping into this after a hard-fought series. I think Florida should just beat them. But, hey, how much do you believe intangibles matter and knowing how to win and finding a way makes a difference? Because this, we're going to find out from Tampa in this round.
Aren't the Florida Panthers basically the Toronto Maple Leafs, but in a less media-intense market?
100% they are. Yeah, they have a couple of guys that maybe are a little more physical. You know, their core guys like Barkov and Huberdeau might be a little bigger. You know, Ekblad, I think, is probably the best D if you put all 12 D together between the two teams. But I don't think I would take their goaltending over Campbell, and I just said Campbell's not awesome. So, yeah, I think Florida's got plenty of flaws. But, yeah, if they get a limping Tampa Bay and beat them, I like Florida over, you know, whoever comes out of Carolina, New York. So this could be the year for Florida where things just kind of line up.
I was going to say, you know, it's funny you draw the straight line between the Leafs and the Panthers, but the big difference, of course, is that the Panthers finally got out of that first round. And I got to admit, if you're a member of the Florida Panthers right now, you have to look at this and say, man, is this ever an opportunity? Because you basically, I don't think they really would have cared who they got out of that first round between the Leafs and the Bolts. Like, they both present their challenges. But the fact that it went to the mattresses and took so much out of both teams, that's great. And then you look at the other side of the draw. I'm going to say it, like, the Rangers were the second-best team in that series. They had the better goalie at the end, but they were the second-best team in that series, and they found a way to get through. And I don't know about Carolina yet. And especially now that it doesn't sound like Freddie Anderson's even remotely close to coming back. So I think if you're looking at the East and you're trying to move the pieces on the chessboard as to who might end up being moving forward the furthest, I do wonder if that's Florida right now, just based on everything that went on in the round one.
Yeah. Well, that's part of what the sadness is here in Toronto, is I think there is a sense that, like, from here that things kind of open up a little bit if you can keep things rolling. So, yeah, I agree with you. The Rangers, to me, are, I don't think they're a great hockey team. They got some good players for sure, but very good goaltending and a couple of stars who can put it in the net. So definitely there is a path for the Florida Panthers to kind of do the thing. It's going to be an interesting year. I mean, realistically, that puts Carolina in the conference final. If you got Carolina and Florida, just shaking in their boots hearing me say that. You know, and then, you know, on the other side, you got something like, you know what? I mean, Colorado, Calgary, you know, we're going to get a team this year go deep and win a cup, I think, quite likely. That's a bit of a surprise.
At least Rogers Sportsnet will have the Battle of Alberta.
Yep.
Who do you think has the edge in this one?
You know, I don't know how much to lean on this. I'm currently writing my preview for it, but Calgary is a runaway favorite to me in just about every department. But you know how playoffs are, and you know you got Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl, and Mike Smith can get weirdly hot. I know he's not an advantage for Edmonton, but he's just one of those guys that like can black out and be Dominic Hasek for a week, and they just need him to be that guy at the right time.
Totally.
He certainly doesn't lack the confidence.
Well, here's the thing with McDavid, and this is crazy that we're at this point. This is how good that he is, that I don't think we've talked enough about what he did in that opening round against the Kings.
Just dragged his team through.
Like,
huh?
It's funny because you talk about, well, all the stars on Toronto ticked their boxes. Everyone was at least a point-a-game player, right? Nylander, Marner, and then Matthews was even more than that. McDavid had 14 points in seven games.
Against a great defensive team that was putting their shutdown guys like Deneau on him.
Yeah, if it wasn't Kopitar, it was Deneau. Like, two Selke-caliber centers, and he went off. What's more, that's the highest scoring first round that we've had in over 10 years, and it's not that far off what Lemieux was doing back in the early 90s, where he was putting up 14, 15, 16 points in a series. He's going to have to do that. Incredibly, I'm saying this out loud, he's going to have to do that and more against Calgary, because I don't think Draisaitl's anywhere near 100%. And I feel like Calgary offensively is got a real chance to explode, because the Oilers aren't the stars. The Oilers will trade. The Oilers will open it up. That's just by nature.
Oh, yeah.
So here's the weird thing. I think there's a potential for McDavid to pile up a ton of points, maybe even more than the first round. But also,
not against Calgary, man.
I don't know.
Not against Calgary.
Look what he just
unless did. The series goes 15 games.
Look what he just did. Look what he just did against Kopitar and Deneau.
Okay.
Yeah, but look, it's Kopitar and Deneau are unbelievable players who are on the ice and marking him. But then there's four other guys out there with him. When you're playing Calgary, so many good guys, so many solid defenders. Like, it's going to be tough sledding, I think, for this Edmonton Oilers team. It's really tough. I think as we talk, I'm going to make my prediction Flames in five. I think that's where I'm going to set.
Flames in five. Well, yeah. That would be quite
maybe
the
no
dynamic.
Tanev for the Flames too, eh? By the way, we should mention that as well. We're speaking of Justin. Yeah, he actually missed game seven of their the Dallas game with an injury, and then Shillington got hurt. In that
and
game
you know
as well.
He's hurt if Chris Tanev misses a game.
Yeah, he might be missing a leg if he's not playing. Like that's the only way that he's going to be out of the lineup.
Hey, Bourne, I know we've still got a bunch of good hockey and eight teams remaining in the Stanley Cup playoffs, but not just because we're in Vancouver. I'm really interested in this offseason. I'm not going to ask you about the Canucks, but I will ask you about the Boston Bruins. If Patrice Bergeron retires, who makes sense to replace him?
Yeah, that's. I guess they'd have some money to play with in that scenario. Huh?
I'm wondering about Malkin.
Yeah, you know, do you see the? Have you guys talked about that? That the apparent offer that those guys were given.
Yeah, because the Fenway Sports Group calculated on their calculators, and they went, "This is what you're worth." Like, I think that's going to be the new era in Pittsburgh. They're going to, you know, like they traded Mookie Betts out of the Red Sox, right? Like, I think they're going to take a very analytical approach, and they certainly don't have any emotional attachment because they're in the new ownership group. I'm wondering how Crosby's going to react if, like, apparently he was not happy about the low ball offers to Evgeny Malkin and Chris Letang, and yet from a non-emotional standpoint, it kind of makes sense that the Pittsburgh Penguins at some point have to turn the page.
Well, you know, I'm now as we're having this chat, I'm like, I should get Brian Burke on our show because, like, there is so much more to what you offer a guy than his value as a hockey player. You know, like, what does it mean for the franchise and the legacies to, you know, keep those stars happy and a part of your organization? And you know, one of that scenario where a guy doesn't come to any of the events for the next 30 years because they leave, you know, with a bad breakup or something like that. I don't know. There's got to be more respect than $5 million a year, like Malkin in particular. So, yeah, I get it. I get the calculations of it all. And but if they are going to move on, it's fun for us to sit here and go, ooh, who goes where? Like, does Crosby like – who would Crosby play for? You know, is he like Montreal? He's from out east. I don't know.
Well, we should also mention on the subject of Montreal yesterday, that report kind of got snuffed out thoroughly that Bergeron was going to entertain the idea of going back to Quebec and signing with the Canadiens. That rumor was out there for a while.
But it does seem like he's done, doesn't it?
It sounds like he's done. He basically said he was like along with Rask. He's like, the only place I'm going to play is Boston. He pretty much said that in his end of year remarks yesterday. But, you know, we talked about this on Monday when we came in. All the great stories and all the big notable stories that emerged over all those game sevens in the Stanley Cup playoffs in round one. One of them was Bergeron taking an extra long time at the end of that series against Carolina to hug every single guy when he came off the ice and kind of say his farewells. So I do wonder if, and it's weird, I'm not ready to live in a world where Patrice Bergeron isn't playing hockey for the Boston Bruins because he's been doing it forever, and it's just part of one of those things that you just kind of have come to know as you watch hockey over the last decade or so.
Well, and has anyone ever won a major award, one of the few major awards, then retired? Like, he got my vote for the Selke, first place.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know. I don't know if that's a common thing for a guy to go out. This is extremely on top if he decides to step away. You know, you wonder if you would do something like Rask, where it just takes some real time and not get through the grind of the first half of the year and find himself later for cheap or something like that. That would be very Bruins, wouldn't it? Bergeron's playing for 800 grand next year for the second half of the year.
Yeah, actually, you bring up a good point because I think they were trying that with Krejci all year too. It's like, don't worry, Krejci will come back later on in the year. It didn't work out that way. But that is right. I could very well see it going that way. Hey, Bourne, thanks a lot for doing this today, man. We really appreciate it. Have a good show today. We'll do this again next Tuesday.
All right, guys. Chat soon. Thanks.
Thanks, bud. That's Justin Bourne, Fan 590, Sportsnet NHL analyst here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. A guy that makes a lot of sense for Boston just in terms of where he's at.
Oh, is JT Miller again? Come on, man.
And I love the storyline behind it as well. Nazem Kadri.
Yeah. That makes sense.
He fits
the bill. That makes sense, for sure.
And then they know his history of getting suspended in the playoffs, so they're already comfortable with it when he does it.
Would they have room to go Malkin and Kadri? Probably not.
Here's the thing. I've heard this Malkin.
Because here's the thing.
I've
like
seen the Malkin thing as well.
But the 2C thing has been an issue for Boston anyway, right?
I have an equally hard time seeing Malkin go somewhere else other than Pittsburgh as I do with Bergeron going somewhere else other than Boston.
Well, what do you think Malkin's going to do? Just retire?
Possibly. I mean,
I don't think it's the right time to go back to Russia.
No. Although, I don't know where his mind's at. I'm sure he's got a ton of family there. Let's put that aside, though.
Sure.
You know, it might be the reality that other teams in the NHL aren't ready and willing to splash a ton of cash to bring Malkin aboard, right? I mean, for all the things that Pittsburgh is reportedly doing.
Yeah.
Other teams might have those concerns as well.
I just think it's interesting that you could have a bunch of top six centermen move this offseason, whether it be in a trade or whether it be in free agency. Nazem Kadri, Evgeny Malkin. I mean, if you want to throw JT Miller into that conversation, feel free. It's on the table right now that he could be traded. Jim Rutherford has said it himself. He's like, if the contract doesn't make sense, we'll trade him.
Yeah. There's the trade route and there's the free agent route. Is the two big differences here. Is the three guys that we mentioned, the veteran guys, Malkin, Bergeron, Kadri, those are all free agents. The trade market could be entirely different.
Speaking of top six centermen, you must be enjoying the anxiety in Toronto about what to do with John Tavares. Because it now seems like they got to move him to the wing because you can't keep up defensively. Offensively, he's still a good player, but defensively, he's become a bit of a liability because of his foot speed. That seems to be like the one unmovable contract in Toronto, and not just because he's got full control of it.
You know, it's really funny that you mentioned that because the other day I was thinking about
I'm rarely right.
Yeah, that's true. within the context of what Jim Rutherford said about signing player X, in this case Miller, to a long-term contract when they're a little bit further along in their careers when they're closer to 30. And the math that Rutherford very specifically laid out was you take the first 3 years of a contract, you take the last 3 years, and then you balance it out, acknowledging that you're going to get good production in the first three, also acknowledging that he's going to deteriorate in the back nine of the contract, meaning those back 3 years. Guess what year Tavares is in the contract? 4.
Yeah.
So the math checks out. So if you're Dubas and you subscribe to
he's 31. I mean, that's the age that it happens, guys.
If you're Dubas and you subscribe to that Rutherford theory, or maybe it's just a longstanding theory among GMs, this is kind of how it's supposed to go. You got your good years out of Tavares on the big money long-term contract for a guy that was too close to 30. Now you have to live with the back part of it, which you knew was coming. Within the, and here's the thing. I bet when Dubas signed this contract, he probably assumed that in the first 4 years of the John Tavares contract, his team would win, you know, a playoff round.
Yeah.
And that's fair.
Yeah.
I would say the same thing. If you signed Tavares for, $11 million a year, you would say, okay, this might age poorly, but don't worry about it. In years 1, 2, 3, and a bunch of playoff rounds. They didn't.
It's Alfred and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. AJ Hafley is going to join us next to talk about the Colorado Avalanche. And then at 7:30, a Vancouver sports media legend, Dan Russell, to talk about his new book. It's going to be a great hour. It's going to be a great final 2 hours. Well, it'll be goodish. It's Alfred and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650.
You're listening to the best of the day.
I say you and you the best.
Halford and Brough.
Tuesday. Happy Tuesday, everybody. Halford Brough, Sportsnet 650. Halford and Brough of the Morning is brought to you by the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. Experience the Dilawri difference today by visiting your nearest Dilawri Acura dealer today. We are in hour two of the program. Dan Russell's going to join us in just a moment here. I need to tell you that hour two of this program is brought to you by North Star Metal Recycling. Vancouver's premier metal recycler pays the highest prices on scrap metal. North Star Metal Recycling. They recycle, you get paid. Visit them at 1170 Powell Street in Vancouver.
Are we going to start this segment off with Dan Russell saying, you're getting sued for using my music?
Yeah, I was wondering about that, but we'll see. We'll see. He is the host of the longest running 30-year run as Canada's longest running and most listened to radio show. We're very excited to have him on the program now, a Vancouver sports radio legend, Dan Russell, now on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. Good morning, Dan. How are you?
I'm great, but and I'm not going to sue, but did you guys stand up for the Sports Talk National Anthem or no?
Yeah, of course, yeah. Obviously.
Hats were off.
Yeah, hats were off. Yeah. It was...
Okay, the hats were off. All right.
So, Dan, I've had a number of surreal moments in Vancouver sports media. One of them was when I was in the press box at Rogers Arena, and I was just talking in the press box with Jim Robson, and I was like, what am I doing here? Like, this is a guy that I listened to when I was a kid. He was a legend. And I feel the same way about interviewing you, in that you were such a big part of my childhood and me becoming a fan of the Vancouver Canucks, me becoming a fan of the entire Vancouver sports scene. And now I'm interviewing you on the radio. And I wonder if in the last few days doing the media tour for this book that you've written, if you've come to appreciate how much of an impact you had.
Well, first of all, thank you. Second of all, even being in the same sentence as Jim Robson makes me kind of shudder a bit, because you and I have the same sort of experience. When I first met Jim Robson, I was at the Pacific Coliseum and I was a kid, and the Canucks were playing the Boston Bruins, and I wandered my way into the lower press box right beside it, actually. Couldn't get in it. But there was Jim getting ready for Hockey Night in Canada. And I'd say, hi, Mr. Robson. And he said, hi. And he signed an autograph for me. And he had a thermos of tea. He had to assure me, for some reason, this 12-year-old kid, he says, that's tea in there. That's nothing else. He had his egg timer as well. I remember he would, and I said, what's that for? He said, well, I flip that over. And every time the sand runs out, I'm reminded to give the score to the audience. So,
wow.
I mean, Jim Robson is my absolute hero. He is the Vin Scully of Vancouver. So if you put me anywhere near a sentence involving him, it's the highest compliment you can actually give me. I am overwhelmed this week. I had no idea. We put a tweet announcement out last week and just say, well, we teased it for a couple of days. And I said, I have a big announcement. And I knew it was pretty big, but I didn't know it was this big. And we just didn't plan on any media yet or any of the responses that we have gotten. I mean, we're blown away. And suddenly, for the first time really in – because you guys know, when you're doing the show, the first thing that happens is when it ends, you're already planning the next one. You don't even think about the one you just did.
We go to sleep.
Coming and
we just go to bed.
Oh, is that what you
Yeah, we have a okay. 3-hour nap. Cool. I think you worked harder than us.
Maybe, but I have possible. To congratulate you. No, guys, let me get this in. I got to congratulate you guys because I know how sharp you guys are. And I think in many ways you have reinvented this format perfectly for today. And I know how it ended before you found this home. And that felt kind of familiar, although it wasn't in the middle of one of my shows. But when some pinhead decision was executed. But you know what? I admire you guys a lot. I really do.
Well, the industry has changed a lot. Tell us about the book that you've written and maybe take us through what the industry was like for you and how it changed as the years went by.
Wow. It changed. It seemed dozens of times over. I mean, we were constantly having to reinvent ourselves, which is why I, you know, sort of said what I just did a moment ago. I mean, 1984, first of all, on the air, we did the show, and that was an era where there was no cell phones virtually, there was no email, there was no TSN, there was no Sportsnet, there was no fax machines. There was just, you know, people called. Finally, the cell phones came around, and it was such a novelty to get a call on a cell phone. I made the caller honk their horn, and this went on for a decade. You know, the next call's on the cell phone. And we'd start guessing a little bit what kind of vehicle they were. And then one person tries to up the other one. And one day we get a call from a guy in an 18-wheeler, big rig, and he horns his horn. And not to be outdone, one of the captains of BC Ferries on a run late at night, he honks the ferry horn for us as he gets on the show. And then a CN or CP rail conductor did the same with his train about a month later. So everything changed. Management, you know, that's a whole different ball of wax. I mean, the way that, you know, all that stuff changed over the years. But, you know, there was a great value for me being first and we definitely trailblazed and invented the genre in Vancouver. And when we started, there had been one other show in Canada, really, in Quebec at the same time, plus John Short in Edmonton. Did a show rather successfully, I might say, for a lot of years, also called Sports Talk. But essentially in Vancouver and British Columbia, we were it.
We're speaking with Dan Russell. Yes, you do recognize that voice. I was reading a story about you and about how the idea for Sports Talk came about, and it was during the 1982 run to the Stanley Cup Finals for the Vancouver Canucks, and you were driving around in your car afterwards and being like, boy, I'd sure like to hear some talk about that. And you couldn't find any, which I find like it's hilarious right now. And for the youngins tuning in right now, it's like I take it back to the day where I would wake up in the morning and be like, oh, I wonder if the Canucks won. And you like look to the newspaper, or you'd turn on the radio. Like it was it was so different. But that 1982 run, obviously Sports Talk wasn't on then. It started in 1984. But what are some of your fondest memories of the show, maybe as they relate to the teams either going to the Stanley Cup Final or the Lions and the Grey Cup or whatever?
Yeah. So you're right. 1982, I'm 21 years old. The Canucks play in Chicago in the third round. And in game one, Jim Neal scores in double overtime. I go to my car. I'm so excited. I'm just a fan. I kind of was on the radio at CJOR in the sports department, but I'm pretty young and I'm a fan. And I go to the car and I was just so excited. The Canucks won the first game of round three. They've never been past round one before. And then 2 days later, Nilsson is lifting the white towel. And I do the same thing. And I'm going, I can't be the only one that is craving something after the game. So that was the impetus of it. And by the way, 40th anniversary of the Islanders winning was yesterday, 1982, at the Pacific Coliseum. And I was in the dressing room for that because I was in the media, but not on the road games. And Billy Smith, the New York Islanders legendary goalie, here I am 21 years old in the dressing room with a microphone, and they're just hooting and hollering. No champagne virtually because it was a Sunday and there was no booze allowed on Sundays and nobody thought to get champagne ahead of time. So they have beer and Billy Smith, they're all excited and they're throwing the beer around. And Billy looks at me because I was the closest one to him. He didn't know me from Adam. He says, hold this. I said, hold what? He said, hold the Stanley Cup. I said, what? He puts the cup in my midsection. I'm hugging the cup while he's filling beer onto the top of the mug. So, I mean, it was like, how surreal can you get? And then you talk about the greatest moments. I mean, the Vancouver Canucks' greatest moment, as everybody, I think, would agree, was the June of 1994. Mm. And that was where we peaked. That was our peak time. Our show was with the Canucks, home and away. And it's probably the part of the book that brings a tear to my eye because I write about after game 7, which we went 7 hours from Manhattan. I got out at 8 in the morning, 5 a.m. Pacific, and it's bright, sunshiny June day, and the newspaper hawkers are, extra, Rangers win the cup, Rangers win. And I go, holy smokes, it's finally hit me. The Canucks did not win the cup. I get on the, we went right to the Grand Hyatt, that's where we were staying. We grabbed our luggage, we got a plane to Toronto. I got on the second flight, the Air Canada flight. They put the news on in the cabin. That was the first time I saw the riot, and I had reported on it for hours on end. I hadn't even seen a lick of it. But anyway, that
you didn't see it on social media?
Not quite. No, I didn't bring my cell phone with me. But anyway, the part of the book that brought a tear as I was writing it was, I'm at the back of the plane. We've done all this coverage, home and away. It was a marathon and a half. And we really felt we had provided something to a BC audience. And going back to your 1982 comment, you know, there was nothing there. And here we were the next time they went to the final. And we serve the British Columbia sports fans with a gathering spot, game nights, off nights. It was so rewarding that I felt like, wow, this was what I was kind of meant to do in broadcasting. Anyway, it really brings back great memories that our show, and people still talk about it to me all the time, that our show, that they listened during that great run.
I'm really glad that you brought up that phrase, like a meeting point for British Columbians, because I don't know if you've seen the Mike and Mad Dog 30 for 30 with Mike Francesca and talking about the history that they had. But one of the great lines from the documentary is they didn't just talk about sports. They talked about sports, how New Yorkers talked about sports. And that's what made them so popular and really changed the game locally. You know, when you go back and look at it, how important was you not just to be a voice for sports and a voice on the radio, but within this particular market and this particular province, it's very unique. And you have to kind of be here and live it to experience it. But to be able to talk to Vancouverites and British Columbians the way that they talk about the Canucks and other sports, how important was that to you?
You know, you guys are bringing up something I haven't thought that much about. I think you're right. I think that's a good point. And, you know, because I'm so close to it and I grew up in Vancouver and I was the perfect age when the Canucks came in the NHL. I was 3 days shy of my 10th birthday. So you imagine, you're 10 years old. I just got introduced to hockey through Bob Orr on Hockey Night in Canada 2 years earlier. And now the Canucks are in the NHL. So why I'm saying that is that I can speak to the entire history of the franchise. I've been alive for all of it. I was at their very first victory, October 11th, 1970. So I know what you're saying. But the other side of that, and I take that, and I thank you for actually telling me that because I never really gave that enough thought. What I do think, though, is that, and maybe people don't really know this or it's lost on them, and that's okay because it means I was doing my job, and that's this. I believe I was a broadcaster who happened to be doing a sports show, not a sports fan who just happened to be on the radio. My skill is broadcasting. I studied it. I had idols like Jim Robson, like Larry King, like Vin Scully. I mean, I went to, you know, their universities, if you will. I everything they did that I could hear, I wanted to know what made them great. And I listened to a lot of radio as a kid. And not just sports, Pat Burns, Jack Webster, Terry Moore, all the people at CJOR, at CKNW, Jack Cullen at night. I mean, I was a radio nerd or junkie. If you'd indulge me one story, in the early 70s, KFI Los Angeles, which is 570 on the AM dial, which used to come in at night pretty well until Sea Isle took the 650 signal over, and it kind of blocked that at night. But they were the voice of the LA Kings. But they were also the voice of the LA Lakers. And the Lakers took priority, which meant when they both played on the same night, the Kings were on tape delay. So a few Fridays, I remember for sure, the Canucks hosting the Kings, and I would listen to the game on CKNW, and then wait anxiously for 11 o'clock to hear the entire game once again on KFI Los Angeles. True story.
So what makes a good broadcaster?
I think if we start with the area of talk show hosts, especially, I think the best broadcasters are the best listeners. I think the best broadcasters are the most curious. I like to think that my interviews were a strength, maybe my best strength. I believe I could. I mean, I did over 25,000 interviews. I was remarking yesterday that if you took every seat at Rogers Arena and I sat at every one of them, we wouldn't be at 25,000. So, I mean, I got more practice doing interviews than anybody. But Larry King, that was one of my idols. He asked great, short, tight questions, listened to the response, and reacted after the person he was speaking with, the interview subject, completed. There's a lot of people. I remember Tony Gallagher once told me, and he was going up against me on CKWX. They'd hired him to take my old slot in the building that you're sitting in right now, guys. I went over to CFMI after spending 1 year at CKWX, and they hired Tony to go head to head with me. And he comes up to me at the press box a couple months in, and Tony's a nice guy. He goes, Ross, I don't know how you do it, but you know, I have a list of questions. And if I'm interviewing Mike Keenan and he says that he murdered three people on the way to the studio, I would say, well, but what about your power play? He was telling me that he wasn't listening because he was just so uptight about the whole thing. And Tony, of course, had a great career and now in the Hall of Fame and such. But just that story, to answer your question, I believe that was my skill. And as a broadcaster, the best broadcasters to me are the best listeners.
So, Halford, if you were listening, short, tight questions.
I missed that part.
Yeah,
sorry.
He wasn't listening. Yeah, he was on Twitter. So sorry about that, Dan. So the way we connect with the listeners is through the text inbox, which is different than the way you connected with the listeners. And as I go into the Dunbar Lumber text line, there are approximately 600 questions about the pauser and your relationship with the pauser. Tell us first, for the people, maybe some of the younger listeners that aren't familiar with the pauser, who was the pauser? Why did he get the nickname the pauser? And what are some of your memories of the pauser?
The pauser's actual name, which most people did not know, was Paul LaFleur, who sadly passed away a handful of years ago, about age 56, I believe. One day, I'm on CJOR. I can't quite remember. I think it was CJOR. I just take a random call, and this guy, he had this very unique voice. But it wasn't so much his unique voice. It was his pacing. So he, and he was highly opinionated, and he thought he knew more about the Canucks than any management figure, which was a great and funny shtick to have, although it was not a shtick for him, but it sure was with me. And I've said many times that, you know, I like to think that I brought out the best in him, but he probably brought out the best in me. He was menacing, but he had a sense of humor as well. And I would promo. I mean, who promos? Oh, the pauser's on the line. And I'm like, I'll say he's, by the way, Pauses on hold. Our phone lines were jammed in those days. We'll get them in a few minutes, and I'd wait 15 minutes knowing for sure people would keep listening because you never knew how he was going to conduct himself on the air. But he was brilliant, and going back to your previous question, he had a skill, I don't know if he knew it, that a lot of broadcasters do not have, and that was his pacing. He could talk a mile a minute and go, 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 and then suddenly he would get to the punchline, and he would slow it down. He was kind of like Paul Harvey in the rest of the story. But and so he did that on the first time he called. I said, will you speed it up, please? You're just doing a lot of pausing, and I can't figure out why you're doing that. And then he did it again and again. I said, you're nothing but a pauser. And for some reason, that nickname stuck.
Dan, did you have any good run-ins with the Vancouver Canucks over the years, maybe management or coaches or players? I feel
really?
Like you might have. Yeah, that is a question that you let's set them up, knock them down.
Well, you know, the relationship I had with Brian Burke is, and it weaves throughout the book, as you might well imagine. We essentially had ourselves about three chapters, a really good chapter in our relationship, a really bad one, and then something that met in the middle. We had some fun years. We poked jabs at each other. In the early years, he tried to get a little too close sometimes to influencing me, but we would jab each other. I remember one day telling him, why don't you let me worry about my first place radio show and you worry about your last place hockey team? That kind of shut him up, at least for a couple minutes. There is lots there. You have to read it to get the thing in context, because our relationship did go sour at a time. Now, it was thanks to him resuscitated, and I do appreciate that. But I have to lay it all out in the book. I did. And I think some people are going to be pretty surprised as to how turbulent that was and how ugly it got off the air. But, but mostly the Canucks were really respectful of our show, thankful for our show. They never had a form before. Burke was the very first regular guest on our show. And I know you guys have regular guests, and all the shows now have regular guests. Nobody had a regular guest back then. And then he led me, the first night he was on, I remarked that, this is wonderful that you're on. I'd love to have you on more often. He says, I'll come on every week. And I didn't know he knew that he was actually serious, but he never missed 12 months a year. And every Wednesday, the weekly Canucks update with Brian Burke, people called it appointment radio. And it really was. You didn't want to miss, because in those days, guys, management, they didn't go on the radio, but if they did, they weren't going to say boo. They were very vanilla. Or not Berkey. He would say stuff. And, he threatened to fight Doug Lidster, one of his own players on our show, over a contract. So there was stuff that went on that made national headlines. But he was really, really a big part. He didn't invent our show, but he took it to a new level. That was absolutely no question about it.
Dan, this has been wonderful and remarkable, and it's great to have you on the program previewing everything that's coming with the book. Our text message in basket is filled, and there's a lot of people that are really enjoying this walk down memory lane, and they're also saying that it's great to hear you back on the airwaves. It is great to hear you back on these airwaves. I want to wish you the best of luck with everything moving forward with the book. We're going to put it up on our social media channels, and we'll shout it out as well. But from both of us, thank you for the kind words earlier in the call. We really appreciate those. Thank you for everything that you did that allowed us to have these kind of jobs where we're at in our careers. And thanks for doing this today. This was a lot of fun.
Wow. You guys are so nice. And I have a new website, danrussellsportstalk.com. There's a lot of old audio there. And this weekend in the Sun and Province, they're starting a 5-part series. They're running excerpts from the book starting in the Saturday Vancouver Sun. So thank you for indulging me to get that out there. But guys, keep on keeping on. It's important. You know the market. We could go on about that sometime if you want. It's so important that there is shows like yours still out there. We all know that if left to the devices of Toronto management, I want to throw out there mostly, if left to their devices, there wouldn't be shows like yours necessarily. So keep on going on, guys. And thanks very much for having me. I really, this was my last sports talk station, you know, that 650. So there you go.
Well, yeah, the newbie says hi, Dan.
Yes, and also Greg says hello.
Oh, yes, newbie. I thought he was laddie with you guys, but I worked with him, and he was definitely newbie to me.
I didn't know his name was Greg. Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Dan. That was a true pleasure.
Thanks, Dan.
Have a great day, guys. Thank you for having me.
You too. Thanks. That's Dan Russell, Vancouver sports talk radio legend here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. We got a lot more to get to in the final hour of the program. Thomas Drance is going to join us. We'll circle back on some of the Canucks conversations from earlier. And it's what we learns in the 8 o'clock hour as well. Get yours in now. What did you learn over the last 24 hours in sports? Let us know. It's the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650.